This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. With me is Daniel Mark Epstein, who is our poet. He's a biographer, historian, playwright, musician, essayist, but today he is our poet, and here he is, Daniel Mark Epstein.
Nice to be here, Grace. This first poem actually could have been written for this occasion, between two old friends, but it wasn't. It was written several years ago. It's called Apologies. It's good to get the apologies out of the way before we do anything else. Apologies. I'm sorry. I thought you were someone I knew long ago, and yet you look the same. A woman who believed she knew me, too, in another life. Was it Rome or Timbuktu, New York or Paris, I first heard your name? I'm sorry. I thought you were someone I knew just now as I passed you on the avenue, and if you were first to speak, I would not blame a woman who believed she knew me too, for time plays tricks on all of us. What seemed true forever stutters, fades, a guttering flame. I'm sorry, I thought you were someone I knew. Yet, after so many years, the ingenue who blossomed in my sight and then became the woman who believed she knew me too would be old by now and wizened. Not like you, a beauty bound for love, acclaim, and fame. I'm sorry, I thought you were someone I knew, a woman who believed she knew me too.
That's Daniel Mark Epstein. You know, I'm in love with your vowels. And do you know that we could teach your poetry for the vowels? That is the motion lotion, Daniel. But let's just talk about it for a minute. I have this book, and it is called Dawn to Twilight. It is your most recent, and it is, I know there's one more coming up, but it is a retrospective of your work. And you said that poetry was the most important thing in your life. You said this in an interview to a newspaper. Tell me more about what you meant. You, who have all these gifts and accomplishments, said that poetry is the most important thing.
Well, it's where I began my writing life. And I can't remember when I wasn't in love with language and the rudiments of all of my compositions, whether it's historical a biography or a short story or a play. And it all begins with vowels and consonants and the music of language.
It does.
For to me, poetry has been the building block of my writing life.
Well, then let's hear two together and see what you're talking about. I have to tell everyone who you are before that. You are a biographer. And you are always on work on a new biography. And four of your books have been translated into several languages. And we'll talk about that after the poetry.
All right. This poem was composed over the course of many years traveling back and forth to New York from Baltimore when I was working in the theater. We've all spent time on trains and daydreamed looking out the window. This poem is called Heading Home. I watched the miles, I saw my life go by, a drumbeat of bare trees and frozen ponds, forlorn stations, ruined factories. I must have dozed, my head against the glass. Women I dreamed I would have died for once mourned me in a dream. South by southwest, our train cleaved the horizon, pushed the sun toward somebody else's sunrise, while heaven and earth denied my day was done, painting a fantastic continent of cumulus and ether, air and mist, real as any land to a waking man. A wall of purple hills sloped to the shore in fluted cliffs, cloud archipelagos, edged with golden beaches, jeweled a sea bluer than our sky. Had I missed my stop? Now was I on my way out of this world, alone on the express to Elysium, lotus trees, the lost woman of my dreams. Shadows deepened, and the speeding train rolled on into twilight. Slowly then, I came to myself, cold, woke to the thought, this is how it must be at the end of the line. You cannot tell the water from the sky, mourners from the dead, or clouds from land. The fire of the sun has tricked you blind, and earth, air, and water join in one.
You cannot tell the water from the sky. Let's hear another.
Yeah, this is a little drama. Imagine a restless group of teenagers in a class and a teacher who's probably is ready to go home. Tell us a love story, pleaded the class in chorus. Our lessons are all done. Now don't lecture or bore us, they prattled, except for one, Helen, whose gaze looked lost in the maze of willow branches, the girl the boys liked most, for the faraway blue of her eyes and brown hair straight as rain. Tell us a love story, please, they begged the teacher again. He frowned and longed for the bell, saying, all the love stories I know end in heartache or death. Then Helen from the back row called at last from her daydream in the voice of an innocent lover. Tell us a love story anyway and stop before it is over.
You bring that one home. Now pretend your poetry was not your poetry. How would you describe it? Now don't own it. Just think about what the elements are. What do you think is happening in those poems, in all of your poems?
Well, there are lots of different kinds of poems. I mean, in that poem, there's a real, you know, there's a beginning and a middle and an end. It has a sort of dramatic arc to it. I would say that in all of the poems, there's a music. The three poems that I've read for you just now have different kinds of music. The first is a villanelle. The second is just a straightforward narrative in iambic pentameter. The last is actually a ballad. But all of them, you know, all of them are based on some sort of a musical phrase. There's a core emotion that's charging the poem. But I've written so many different kinds of poems, and actually the poems that made my reputation in the 1970s and early 80s were long dramatic monologues on historical subjects, poems that are too long for the format of this program.
Longer than Howl. Longer than Ginsberg.
Some of them are longer than Howl, yeah. One of my poems was compared to Howl, actually, young men's gold. So it's a very good question, but a question that would take as long to answer as responding to each individual poem, because it's almost always different.
That is the point. That is the point. You do everything available. You use dialogue, you use meter, you use tone, you use situation and plot, you use characters. You do everything a person can do with language, and yet it is crafted. And it's been called crystalline, and it's been called metrically perfect, and it's been called everything imaginable. So let us go to your newest venture, which I recommend everyone to see many times, and it is Cruel April. Tell us what you've done. You've now finally approached technology, which I think they had to carry you kicking and screaming.
Well, somebody else was responsible for making the film from the poems, but in April of 2020, during the first shelter-in-place orders of the pandemic, I was very inspired. I was very anxious and worried, as all of us were, and I had this incredible inspiration to write a sonnet sequence, 14 sonnets about many, many different aspects of the pandemic. And I was very excited by these. And as soon as I started to share them, people said, you know, you should think about doing a video with this. And a very gifted director, Douglas Trapp, found some actors, including Tyne Daly, Paul Hecht, and Jennifer Van Dyke, some
famous actors.
And they put together this this video, which is available on YouTube and elsewhere, of the actors reading the poems over a beautiful montage of paintings and photographs. So anyway, it's not all of the sonnets, but I would say 10 of them are represented in that film. And I can read some of them now if you'd like to hear them.
Read one or two, but I would like to know if you curated the art.
I didn't. No, I was consulted, you know, once they had put together the art, which mostly Douglas Trapp gathered from artists at the Tivoli Gallery in New York. It was so beautiful that I really didn't, there was hardly any image that I disagreed with or wanted omitted, but they did, when they were actually making the film, they wanted feedback from me about the pacing and, you know, the way things were cut and so on.
Well, you know, it's a work of art in every language, so that people just have to Google Cruel April plus Daniel Mark Epstein, because there are other Aprils that get in your way, you know. And I promised a few details. Daniel has published 8 volumes of poetry, and his poems and biographies of Amy Semple McPherson, Edna St. Vincent Millay, Abraham Lincoln, and Bob Dylan are the ones that were translated into many languages. Give us 2 from Cruel April, and let's have everyone look that up after the show.
Okay, I'm going to read the prologue, and then one other poem. This may have happened centuries ago to strangers who told a different tale of pestilence and calamity on a scale thought unthinkable then, just as now. The April sun rose darker than a crow, and wind out of the east stirred up a gale that blew out lives like candles. Surreal. The song is ancient, tone and tremolo. Listen to me, you stars and daffodils. You are my last and only audience. My voice under the sky against the hills ricochets as it seeks true sound and sense in a world gone mad. My worn heart fills with anguish for our blighted innocence. Virtual reality. The restaurants, bars, and barbers are shut down. Theater, stadium, and concert hall are dark and vacant. An ominous pall has settled upon the country and the town. The tightrope walker and the circus clown wilt in quarantine. Schools and colleges all are closed, and the learning is virtual. The bride is virtual. So is the wedding gown. The flight is canceled, train stalled in the station, and everyone in public wears a mask, not just the bandit, the nurse, and surgeon. You will not see the stranger's face. Don't ask. Things will be done remotely, remotely done, in a virtual world that takes real life to task.
The visual with that one is so stark and so realistic that it matches perfectly the word. Now, in the prologue, one has to listen to the similes. You have to, it's an exercise. It's the way you address, a direct address among the similes, where you say, listen to me, stars and daffodils. So you mix so many tropes, so many tools and skills in one short poem that I had to watch it again and again. And you know why? Because it's so meditative and I'm so high strung. I really recommend this 14 minutes to chill and to sit among the glamour and beauty of words and visuals. Really, it's your a crowning thing for you. So I want to go back to when I first met you and you had black hair, and I did too. And you came to my class because your first book, No Vacancies in Hell, had just been published. I was your first purchaser, and you came and talked to my class, and you were already a star. I mean, you were already published in The New Yorker and The Nation. And for a young person from Baltimore, well, actually, I think you were born in Maryland, but you were discovered and you moved to Baltimore to be with the Johns Hopkins group, right? Elliot Coleman?
No, that's not actually why I went to Baltimore. But I did have a relationship with Elliot Coleman that went back to my teenage years.
He discovered you. Did he not discover?
I would say so. Yeah. I mean, it's very flattering to me to think so. But yes, I had an uncle who knew somebody else who was at the writing seminars. And I was writing these poems when I was 12, 13 years old. And anyway, they found their way to Elliot Coleman, and he invited me to come. And I was just a kid. He invited me to come to Hopkins and talk to him. And my mother drove me over to Baltimore, and he was just so encouraging. And that really was that really was discovering myself as a poet, to be acknowledged by Elliot Coleman. But I've always loved Baltimore.
And then didn't you live there
for 46 years?
Yeah, that's right.
I lived there for a long time,
and just a small part of a century. And I was teaching at Antioch. And you talked to my class, and then I saw a play of yours at the New Theater Project, which is still going on, by the way. And it's a little different. Yeah, but it's going, it's very, very prominent in American theater, still breaking new ground. And so the play was, let me see, what was the title?
Jenny and the Phoenix.
Jenny and the Phoenix. And that won the Prix de Rome Award, and you went to Rome. Okay. How did that play get noticed, and what happened to it? Where did it go after that?
After that, it was optioned by Joseph Papp at the Public Theater. It had many readings there. And I still think it's one of my best plays, and it's still there if anybody wants to produce it. But I've actually continued writing plays for most of my life. And my newest project is a new play that I'm working on right now.
Can you tell us just a bit about it? Spoiler? Just the title, maybe?
It's called The Somerset Tavern. It's set in colonial Maryland, and it concerns a play that was produced by some Englishmen that was considered treasonable. And the players get tried for treason, and they have to act out the play in front of the justice.
What an idea!
Yeah, so there's a play within a play,
and what an idea! This is going to be big time. I hope it gets off Broadway. Is of course the thing now. On Broadway is just revivals, right? And that's having a few turns at Kenyon College.
Well, they're interested in it. We'll see how it goes. Plays get. They don't get produced right away. They're workshopped, and you get to see just how good it is and whether or not it's going to be stage worthy. So
and people
we'll
don't know it costs money to put on a play. That's the problem. It is not as easily done as writing a poem financially. So give us another poem, because throughout all of this, we wish to always remember that first and foremost, you started with poetry.
Well, I'm going to read a couple of new poems. This is called Silverfish. Silverfish. There's a hole in this page, the size of an eyelet. You poke in cardboard to let the sun and moon slip through so you can view the eclipse without going blind. I did not make it. No, the little window was the work of a silverfish. But let's make the most of it, to see and be seen as if this was our fondest wish. Peering between the lines, now I see you daydreaming, as people do when no one is watching. It is a God's eye view from where I stand, eternity on either hand, and your face before me in a moment of candid beauty, like the cracked seed of creation from which swirled the unity and variety of the world.
Cracked seed of creation.
Okay, one more quick one.
This is going to be a new book?
Yeah, I'm hoping that my collected poems are going to come out in about a year and a half or 2 years. We'll see about that. I don't know about the timing yet. Now, you know, I really miss Maryland. I lived in Maryland almost all my life, and now I'm in Ohio. And so I'm going to read you a Maryland poem about the eastern shore of Maryland and the Nanticoke River, which is runs through Dorchester County. As I lay down beside the Nanticoke, watching that tidal river flow and wind, wave and ripple parting the marsh grasses, rolling on forever, making innumerable turns as it runs through the countryside to the horizon, pouring its watery soul into the meadows, I shut my eyes and tried to envision the first wave, the nascent pulse that came at the dawn of time out of the dark, flooding the earth. Every day the river changes as seasons, stars, and clouds pass over, and men ponder, and yet we call it by the same name, the river, the Nanticoke, after a tribe of Indians who once lived here and fished and hunted by these banks, the rushing water, the very same sound. Likewise, a man changes in body and mind. I sleep and wake, and will not be the same tomorrow. My body's strength and health, this body which time shortens and consumes. As winter gnaws the days, will not be as it is. And yet my name will follow me to my grave. The echo of an echo my mother first uttered will hover in stone above my ashes, never changing, although I am no longer the man who lived here. Passed through these bright stanzas singing.
I am no longer the man who lived here. That's a good title for a book. I like the way you pivot in the poem. When you start with likewise, you shift energy. And you do that a lot in your poetry. You set up a narrative, and then all of a sudden you turn a corner in the middle of the poem, which gives it a new infusion of energy. So I'm sure this isn't all conscious, but it's just your DNA. This is just what you know to do because you've been fooling with words for so long.
And that's part of the natural structure of the sonnet with the octet and the sestet. There's a turn, you know, in the middle of it. And I think the fact that I've been writing sonnets since I was a teenager sort of internalized it. As you say, it's in my DNA and your DNA and everyone's to make that sort of turn in the middle of a work of art or in the middle of life.
In the middle of life. It's a little volta we're both experiencing right now in our own lives, right? And so let us go back to your work. And one thing which I know, and I don't know if everyone knows, is every once in a while I hear a story of yours on NPR. And it is a Christmas story, and it's a holiday standard, Star of Wonder. Now, why is this so consistently performed, and why is it so well loved?
I think it's... And when it first came out, this is a very, very important story in my life. It was about a family where Hanukkah and Christmas are both celebrated. And a lot of us, a lot of us have mixed traditions in our families. And I think that this story in 1986, when it was first published, it touched a lot of people in terms of trying to bring families together separated by religion, you know, by different religious faiths and backgrounds and so on. So it had that effect. It was very important in my life because before I wrote Star of Wonder, I didn't write anything but poetry and plays. And that really was the beginning of my career as a prose writer.
Oh.
Yes. Yes.
And they say that it is only next to the Christmas Carol in the best known writing for Christmas, in the way it's presented so many times. And you probably don't hear it all the time that it's presented.
Well, I did. The first few years it was done, I was so proud, of course. they aired it actually on All Things Considered.
Right.
I don't think they do the way the culture programming is now. I don't think they do that anymore.
Yes, they do.
That was a huge audience, you know, mm-hmm. to have Star of Wonder read by, like, I think it was read by Susan Stamberg. it was just an extraordinary thing, because as a poet, I mean, you and I had a very good audience in Baltimore in the 1970s, 1980s, but it was poetry. But suddenly to have this story that was read by millions and millions of people was very thrilling.
To go from 200 to 200,000 is a little bit of a boost. And that's an interesting thing about being a professional writer. You have made your living by the grist of the pen. You have not taught, you have not sold yourself out. It's day after day as a writer. So there must be arid periods where you wonder if anyone ever remembered you. And then all of a sudden you get a little award, like a kiss on the cheek from NPR, or a Prix de Rome, or one of your many awards and fellowships. And then I guess the ego energy is renewed. Is that the way it is to be a full-time writer?
One of the most exciting things for me is to get mail. I mean, I get emails. I have a website, and people will read a poem that I wrote 20 years ago or 25 years ago or longer, and they'll write me a note about it. That's really thrilling to me. I think that's probably more important than any prize or award. And the fact that I do have books, I have biographies that have been in print for 30 years, and people are still reading them and responding to them.
Oh.
To me, that's the greatest award that a writer can have.
I want people to know that, because they say so many things to me about writers, and I say, why don't you tell them? Oh, they wouldn't care. Oh, yes, they do.
Yes, they
do. Let's have another poem. Daniel Mark Epstein.
This is another poem from the... the sonnets, pandemic sonnets, Notre Dame. I saw Notre Dame burning, the sheer spire a blinding torch, and knew it was a portent. She had been radiant, kind, and vigilant in times of war and plague. Altar and church witnessed 1,000 weddings before the fire, caskets and coronations, sinner and saint in confession and worship, priest and suppliant, the pageant of every penance and desire. One stray spark and 1,000 years of grace ingrained in timbers, stained glass, and hewn stone went up in smoke. Our Lady's long-suffering face and heart that was wide enough to guard everyone fled to heaven from this ruined place. The church is empty. We are on our own.
We are on our own. I want to go to the decade 2000 to 2010, when you were really so well known for your biographies. And I think we talked about Lincoln and Whitman together on the show, about, 2005 maybe, or 2006. But what a book that is. What a book that is. And there was a trilogy. So that, did you do nothing but Lincoln for 10 years?
For 10 years, yes.
Yeah.
It was the only book I've ever written where I got to the end of the book and I thought, I don't want this to be over, was Lincoln and Whitman, that book that you and I talked about. I loved writing it. I loved talking about Washington, D.C. and during the Civil War. And I loved the double portrait of Lincoln on the one hand and Whitman on the other, who didn't really know each other, but Whitman felt as if he knew Lincoln. Anyway, when I was finished with that, the book did very well for a very literary history. Then I got a contract to do a book on the Lincoln marriage, And that took a lot longer. It was a much more challenging thing because I had to tackle a portrait of Mary Lincoln, who is an extremely controversial and difficult subject. But I was able to do that, and that was probably my most successful biography of all of them, with the exception of the Bob Dylan book, because the Bob Dylan book was translated into so many foreign languages. But anyway, I finished the book on the Lincoln marriage, and I got another contract to do a book on Lincoln's private secretaries. So yes, a whole 10 years.
Right. Lincoln. Well spent. But were they all the same publisher?
No. Let's see. Two of the books. The first book was published by, the first two books were published by Random House.
Yes.
And the third book was published by HarperCollins.
One wonders why didn't Random House just hang on to you and never let you go. We won't get into publishing. It's random, as the teenagers say. But then the most important thing you're doing now is Edna St. Vincent Millay. And how you popped into my mind, although I think of you so much. I was reading The New Yorker and I saw your article about Edna St. Vincent Millay, I don't know, a couple of months ago. And it was about her letters. So please talk about Edna St. Vincent Millay. You know, when I went to college in the 50s, she was disavowed. I mean, I have all of her first editions, actually. And wow. I even have her first review that was ever in the Boston Globe. And I was, in my day, all of us went around campus, you know, quoting her. And I memorized all of her work. But here, she is finally getting the recognition from a man. Thank you.
I wrote a biography of Millay a little more than 20 years ago.
Right.
And that really was the beginning of a revival, an interest in Millay's work. And in order to write that book, I had to read Millay's letters and the diaries. And the diaries, it always seemed to me that the diaries would make a wonderful book. And so, as soon as I finished writing my book and publishing the book, I went to the estate and I asked permission to make another book, to do an edition of the diaries. And for one reason or another, for 20 years, I was not allowed to do that. Hmm. But 5 years ago, I did get permission from the estate to edit the diaries, and they were published by Yale University Press. They did a beautiful job. And I've never had so many reviews. It was really remarkable. The New Yorker and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. I mean, everybody was very, very interested in these diaries because she was not only a great poet, she was a really interesting woman, you know, way ahead of her time in terms of her own personal liberation. So it was a great privilege to be able to write that book.
Where were the primary sources kept?
In the Library of Congress. And I was one of the first people to have access to Millay's diaries right there at the Library of Congress. So I spent all of the summer in the reading room there working on that book. By the way, the Library of Congress has been wonderful to me. I've researched every one of my books there. It's just a great, great place to work. And they're so good to the scholars.
But you cannot take any books out.
No.
So how does that research happen?
Well, they have copy machines. And most of the research that I was doing was with primary resources. So I was looking at manuscripts, the actual letters and diaries.
You can't Xerox those.
Well, they have very good copy facilities. Mm. If you're a scholar, they'll let you do that.
You have championed every kind of verse there is. You have excelled in theater, music, the arts, but you don't start painting. When are you going to start painting?
I don't know. I love painting.
I know it's the next thing.
I have to be an amateur. I have to be an amateur at something.
That's wonderful.
I've also never published a novel. I'll never do that.
Why?
So I just I don't I love to read novels, and I think I know something about the novel, but I don't know how to write one.
So I don't believe it. I think before I die, I will see a novel by Daniel Mark Epstein, because he is the man of all seasons. We are so proud to know you. And so may we have a final poem.
Thank you, Grace. Okay, it's autumn here. I don't know. By the time this gets released, it might be winter, but Meditation After the Autumn Equinox. A maple sapling with a spiral bowl, a corkscrew coiled by a jealous vine, might be a serpent, for all that I can see, rising out of that bramble of barberry. Now that I'm living in the woods, where trees have grown up all around me, I wish the leaves would fall, that one blind wind would blow them all away, make way for sunshine and the stars of Libra, so I might view the fallen tree trunks clearly, moss-edged, and the gold and brown confetti of strewn foliage before solstice is upon us, and snow that makes a ghost of everything. For I am weary of the summer's darkness in this cavern of elms, oaks, and faded maples. I long for the sheer effrontery of the sun. Let it come naked as the day it was born, and leave no stone or thought unturned. For what I want above all, as the year closes in on me, is more light.
And you have given so much light to the world. We haven't finished with you yet, Daniel Mark Epstein. This is program number one. And I wish to thank everyone who has made the program possible. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MAT Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funders are the Sinipet Fund, Nathalie Canavore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin is our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. Thank you.